Good morning and welcome to St. Paul's Bible Study. We'll be starting in just a moment. We are still in the Gospel of Thomas. And I beg your patience as we wait for people to come into the meeting. We'll begin in just a moment.
Hello.
Hi there.
Hi, Sue. This is my husband, Michael, who's joining us today.
Hello.
Oh, look, you can see the punching bag really well. I know that Grace was planning on joining us and that Jeanette is not. And I apologize for the sudden change, but I realized that I could have this and thought that we should. So
very good.
There we go. Michael and I were actually just discussing Logion 36, where we're going to start today. So I will read it out loud and we'll have a moment of quiet while we let it sink in for the introverts. And then we'll start our discussion. Yeshua said, "Do not worry from morning to evening or from evening to morning about having clothes to wear. Make of this familiar passage?
Well, it sort of reminds us to stop worrying about the little stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think it, for my part, a lot of the time when I'm worrying, I don't really do anything very well. I get caught up in the worry and in the fear, and that impacts everything.
Mm-hmm. Takes so, down a lot of rabbit holes.
Yes, yes. And part of what I've been working on is trying to not have that impact me quite so much.
Yeah. I really appreciate... I'm looking at this version, the Jean-Yves Lelou version. And in the commentary, sometimes for me, his commentary misses a little bit of where I kind of see an interpretation. And sometimes it just hits dead center. And I really appreciate the examples he gives from all kinds of traditions about this particular piece of wisdom and how important it is. And I love the quote from the Bhagavad Gita. You have a right to act, but no right to the results of your actions. And it's a very different way of looking at it as opposed to, let us say, the guilt-laden culture that we live in that would have at least some people take too much responsibility for actions that aren't even theirs. And I feel like I have been brought up in this culture where I am very strongly encouraged to take responsibility for actions that aren't even mine. Did somebody die outside?
They're taking down a tree.
So something is dying.
Right. We had to close the front windows just so that I could keep my microphone on. But there was a horrific yell and I thought, uh-oh.
I think it was more of a don't do this yell. I just died yell.
I just lost a limb. It wasn't a tree limb. It was a human limb.
It would have gone on longer if it was... anything horrific.
Right. Sorry for the digression.
So don't worry.
So don't worry. Right. Not my responsibility. Don't worry. Act and then move on. So do I need to call 911? That's where I should have gone. Is this a 911 moment? No? Okay, fine. It's a totally different way of being. And I want to be that way. But I recognize that I am not that way. And that it, for me to shift from not that way to that way is gonna take a lot of concentrated, focused effort.
And practice.
And practice. And prayer and meditation, and it's worth it. Oh, good. I'll put it on the list.
Yes.
I'm not sure if this is a further digression or not, but you're talking about taking too much responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
Makes me think that a whole lot of people are encouraged to take too little responsibility. Like, there are examples of people in power who are, say, my age, and if consequences hit them, some, like the story will be, oh, he was just a kid, he was just learning this.
Right.
And that is also not okay.
Right.
And worrying about anything and taking no action in any direction is kind of useless, wasted energy.
Mm. Yeah, and it's...
If you're going to make worry constructive, it has to be concern rather than worry, and concern will carry you to the next step because it'll give you momentum.
Hmm. Almost as if you're using it like a red flag.
Yeah.
Or a little, you know, a little, that icon on the dashboard of your car.
Yeah.
That tells you
alert.
You need alert. You need to stop and do something.
Yeah.
You need to change your behavior.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to have a catastrophic incident.
So worry is not in itself a horrid thing, but it needs to be used with some sort of constructive behavior with it. Well, so worrying about little useless stuff, like worrying about, oh, what will I wear today? Why should that be a worry when...
Right.
When there are huge things to worry about.
Yeah, it is like a smoke alarm, as you said. Worry would be like letting the smoke alarm go off continually, even after you've dealt with the issue.
And how stressful is it to have a smoke alarm going off?
Yeah, a little more stressful than what to wear.
Right, but that, like, if that is a reasonable equation of what worry really is, and what, like you were saying before, how you can get digressed into just worry, and that it takes all of your energy and your focus, I think it also takes something from your very being. I think the stress of it,
yes,
takes something out of you, or me in this case. And it's like having the dashboard dinging at you for your entire car trip.
Yeah.
And it doesn't stop. Or having the smoke alarm going off three rooms away. And so it's not like right in your ear, but it is
there.
A constant stressor.
And you don't even put it under a pillow.
Not that we've ever done that, of course. Sometimes in our house, they go off for no reason and we can't get them to stop. Anyway.
Can I digress on that note?
Just you know,
a family story.
Yeah.
My youngest son and his wife just moved into a new home in Connecticut. And she had gotten some women to come in and clean the house before the movers got there. And none of them spoke English. And there hadn't been any hot water in coming out of any of the faucets all the time that they had been in and out of the house with the little stops. So some furnace people were there and they said, oh, just turn on the boiler. It probably has been turned off for months. And so just turn it on. Well, the older couple that had owned the house had not been well, and they had carbon monoxide thingies in every room. So they turned the boiler on and every carbon monoxide thing went off, and they're connected to the fire department. So my daughter-in-law was at the house with this little gaggle of women not speaking English, and she didn't speak their language. And she had to get them out of the house because this alert sound kept giving them instructions, get out of the house immediately. And my son was driving up the road with a load of stuff from the house that he was bringing before the movers. And he couldn't get down the road because there were three fire engines racing down towards his new house. So there were a few things to worry about.
Yes. Oh, gosh. That's the worst move-in story I've ever heard.
Me too.
Oh, my goodness.
So pardon me for the digression, but when you mentioned the smoke alarms, it just...
Yeah. Yeah. That's what worry is. Well, let's move on to saying 37. Do you want to read it for us, Sue?
His disciples asked, "When will be the day that you appear to us? When will be the day of our vision?" Yeshua replied, "On the day when you are naked as newborn infants who trample their clothing, then you will see the Son of the Living One, and you will have no more to fear."
Thank you. Let's let that sink in for a moment of silence. What do you make of this?
It kind of ties in with the last one. Why are you worried about what you wear? Newborn infants don't worry about it. Newborn infants could care less as long as they're warm and fed. Mm-hmm. And so and then you will have no fear. When you disregard all the mundane stuff of everyday life, you have nothing to worry about.
Because we get so caught up on little things that don't really matter.
Yeah.
All the Martha Mary things.
And don't you know, that's going to be in the gospel this week.
Oh, is it?
Yes, it is. So you'll hear somebody preach about that.
Yeah, I just think that we're all caught up. I mean, I tell myself, start the day with prayer. Well, before I start with the prayer, I do 15 little things because it's between my bed and where I sit and pray. So those 15 little things, then if something shows up amongst them, it's also sort of something that needs to be done someday, somehow. I pick that up and I work on that. So then about an hour and a half later, I actually sit down and pray.
Mm-hmm.
So I've gotten in the habit now of waking up and just thanking God that I did wake up. And then saying, "Join me for the day and I'll meet you at prayer." And I'm sort of nebulous about when that might be.
I like it. I like it.
He is a loving God and I like that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I really appreciate in this saying that Jesus seems to be saying, he seems to be describing a state of mind that they can achieve that is, it's a state of mind, but it's more than a state of mind. It's a state of being. It's like when your state of mind is so completely embraced all the way to your bones that it's just who you are now. And that for Jesus to appear to them, you know, post-death and all of that, I mean, if it's a one-off vision, okay, you know, you're having visions of the divine, good for you. But otherwise, it seems like we're talking about divine union. Like, how do we return back to God? When will we be able to be with you again? And Jesus answers, when your state of mind is completely different. When all of the stuff that bothers you, you genuinely don't care about anymore. Because all there is God. I mean, that's unspoken, and I added that in there. So, you know, take that one with a grain of salt. But
I think that it's implied, like, naked as newborn infants with, like, nothing extraneous, nothing that you don't need.
The simplicity of it.
Yeah,
because I think that God, while we're here in this avenue of existence, there are things I think where we ought not to be ignoring, we ought to be doing, we ought to be taking care of, we ought to be concerned about it. But if we, well, of course, this isn't what this is about, but I think we get all caught up with the knick-knacky, brick-a-bracky nonsense of life. And we miss the mission. We're worn out and haven't got another minute left in the day. And all we've done is the little nothing stuff.
Yeah.
So maybe if we're like, you know, he said, you have to be like the little children to come to me. So if we are like this newborn or the little child, we're not worried about what are we going to fix for dinner? Where are we going to buy it? Where are we going to find the right outfit for the right person in the family for the right occasion? All this kind of crazy stuff, which are not problems if you're living simply. And and if you're, you know, like my one son always says, well, that's a first world problem. That is not the problem of 90% of the people on the planet. And that's what we should be doing something about.
And, you know, as we're having this conversation, I'm sort of idly looking around and just thinking about what you're saying and thinking about what Michael's saying. And, you know, I'm not at St. Paul's today. I'm at home. You can probably tell this is my home. And I have my iPad, not on a tripod. We are sitting at my secretary, and I have it in the bookshelf in front of me because it's one of those secretaries that goes all the way up. And the things that are in the secretary bookshelves, other than the iPad, are kind of the most important stuff to me and my husband. The most important wisdom books, the journals, the letters from loved ones that we've saved, the stationery, the books that I'm actively reading that have some kind of useful benefit, in addition to all the stuff that helps me do my work. And there's so much crap here. There's so much distraction. And I think to myself, okay, so what's the difference between good stuff and crap. And my definition used to be, well, my stuff is good stuff and other people's stuff is crap. So, and you know, I got that one from my family. So, you know, if I'm surrounded by my stuff, then I'm surrounded by good stuff. And if there's other people's stuff all around me, it's just, where did all this crap come from? So, okay, that's, you know, judgmental but humorous. But then I think, so if the point is to live this deep interior life of oneness with God that is reflected in our words and actions, and that it is predominantly in our thoughts and our feelings, but reflected in our words and our actions, then all of the exterior stuff, whether it's good stuff or crap, helps and supports that and does not detract from that. Because the thing is, dinner still has to get made. And we still have to wear something to the wedding. And we still need to give gifts if that's what we do in our family. And as Jesus said, I think in the Gospel of Matthew, though don't quote me because I could be wrong about that, God knows you need all these things. Right. But it's not the point to worry about them. And so, you know, thinking about the culture of the people at the time, it might have been a genuine concern. Not sure where we're going to get our next meal. That's why we're worrying about it, Jesus. Mm-hmm. Not sure how we're going to replace these clothes, and they're wearing out.
Yes.
And we can't fix them anymore. And we need a new one. And it's a problem. And Jesus's point isn't that your needs are frivolous. It's that no matter what you need, worrying is frivolous.
Yes. And it costs energy.
And it costs energy. And it costs, maybe the most important thing that it costs is your energy and your focus. Yes. And it takes your energy and focus away from where it is supposed to be with God. And so I think about, you know, what it means not to walk through my life in a daze, but to walk through my life and walk through a day as I have sometimes been able to manage, but not reliably and not often, but to walk through my day in a constant conversation with God. Mm-hmm. And the focus is God. And I still make dinner and it's great and I have enough energy to do it. And I still do the work that I need to do that day. And it usually turns out better. And I'm still able to be totally present with people. And again, it usually turns out better, not worse. And it's not God who wants me to be distracted. God wants me to be able to focus, but to focus on the things that are real. That's what I think of when I look at all of this crap.
Well, and that's what a newborn does. A newborn is focused on probably two things.
Yeah.
Even children at play are not focused on thousands of things. They're focused on whatever the element of the moment is.
Shall we look to saying 38? Michael, do you want to read this one?
Okay. Yeshua said, "Often you have wanted to hear the words I speak to you now. No one else can say them to you. And the days will come when you seek me and do not find me."
Thank you, Michael.
You're welcome.
We'll let that one sink in for a moment of silence. make of it?
Well, no one else can say them to you. It's when you're looking for advice or you're looking for comfort, you're looking for somebody to speak to you and tell you some direction, some information that will help you figure out what you're up against and how to handle it. So it has to be somebody with authority. And when Jesus spoke to people, he must have, you know, they followed him, they listened, they waited for him to show up, they looked for him. He must have given some sensibility of amazing comfort and authority, or they wouldn't have. They would have just passed him on the street, said hello, have a good day, whatever. And that's not what happened with him. So that's why we don't find people that can give us that. We get senses of it, we get feelings of it, but we're always looking for more than what we find. So we're looking for him, and we don't always find him. We don't look either deeply or sufficiently with enough energy, focus. I don't know, and I haven't read this far in commentaries.
That's okay, that's okay. What do you think? Got any thoughts?
I think about how Jesus always said things that were surprising. Mm-hmm. Like, I know you mentioned that a lot in your sermons, even if they seem normal to us because we've heard the stories. And it originally they were very surprising, and I like that you emphasize that. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I think of when I hear no one else can say them to you. And also when you were saying, Sue, about Jesus speaking with authority, it reminded me that the people who listened to him and respected him in the Gospels were not always the people that would be expected to. Like I'm thinking of the Romans, who would have no reason to listen to him. Like,
and the taxpayer.
Yeah.
And the tax collector.
Yeah.
The people on the fringes.
Yeah.
One of the places that my head goes to when I hear this saying is my sort of extra Christian perspective of Jesus as an enlightened master. And thinking about that and thinking, okay, Jesus was an enlightened master, probably the only one around, maybe the only one of his generation, maybe the only one on earth at that point. Who knows? Can't tell. Not sure. And so when he says, no one else can say them, these words to you, and there will be a day when you seek me and you can't find me, one of the things that I think about is that an enlightened master deeply understands how much we belong with God, how profoundly we yearn at an unconscious level to return to that sense of belonging with God, and how much we fight it on a conscious level. And yet how much we need it as people. And so the things that they wanted him to say were the sorts of directions and guideposts that only an enlightened master can actually give you. Because everybody else, gosh, they're making a good effort.
Yes.
You know, I am not an enlightened master. The best I can do is make a good effort to help lead people into a deeper relationship with God. And if I was an enlightened master, my good effort would be astounding and very helpful to everyone, because it would be exactly the next step they're ready to take, no matter where they are on the path back to God. But I'm not. And so when I think about no one else can say them to you, it's not that no one else ever is going to ever be an enlightened master, but that for, you know, our reasonable purposes, he's the enlightened master you got. And they're going to kill him. So there's a brief window of opportunity here. Soak it in as much as you can right now. Even if it doesn't make sense, especially if it doesn't make sense, don't try and change it to make it make sense. Because then you'll be doing that thing that unenlightened masters do all the time, which is fake it. And the proof is in the pudding. The very bottom of this particular commentary has a quote from Angelus Silesius, who I have no idea who this is, but I'm guessing somewhere before the 6th century, given his name.
Right.
What does it matter that Christ was born long ago in Bethlehem, if he is not born in me today? And what does it matter that Christ is coming tomorrow, if my heart is not open to receive him today? Hmm. And I like that puts the onus of action back on us. And that, yeah, Jesus is gone. The enlightened master has left the building and returned to God. And there's still something that we can do. Are we doing it? Or are we worrying?
And you're kind of ending this on the worry thing. I was glancing at page 122 on the, you know, just the page before us, and it appears, so I'm going backwards now to the previous page, one of the most beautiful echoes of Lojin 37 is this poem by contemporary author from his Surate of Emptiness. And it might be worth reading and sitting and thinking about it in terms of all three of these that we have read today.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a little bit that I glanced at just kind of makes me think that that's a poem worth coming back to and thinking about.
Yeah.
Probably ties all three of them up together.
Yeah, and I like that the poem really focuses on undoing things.
Yes.
And it makes me feel like I kind of see a huge doodle that you have doodled, that is just a fractal breaking off and making more fractals and more fractals and more fractals. And it's like, that is our attention span. And we get so divided in our focus to the 10,000 things, as the Tao Te Ching says. And the only thing that matters is the one thing. And so all of those 10,000 distractions need to be undone.
Yes, and so just the part that shows up on 122, unburdening your soul, unfailing your failures.
Mm.
If you think about that, that's undoing, and we're busy doing. So undoing is a total reverse thought process.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of like you were talking about earlier, how it would take an awful lot of practice to be able, an awful lot of effort and focus, refocusing. Mm-hmm. So it is refocus to undo something.
Right.
Because our 24 hours a day, even when we're sleeping, we're doing something.
Mm-hmm.
And doing is what probably keeps us alive. Otherwise, we're not. But so like Michael said earlier, about everything he seemed to say to the people that were with him that day comes as a surprise to them. And they're having to rethink because it's not making sense to them. It's a surprise. It's not their usual way of thinking about whatever it is. And that seems to me what this is trying to do from whenever it was written for us today. Unfail your failings. You know, that's making you take a very different look at what you're thinking about, what you're worried, what you're stewing about. Unstew your stew.
Yeah. And it makes me think about some cultures on Earth, not necessarily our Western culture. But I know that the traditional Indian culture, subcontinental Indian, there is a strain of thought that when you get to be a certain age, and by a certain age, I mean well past retirement age, you have to enter the undoing phase. They call it something else, but that's what we're talking about here.
Mm-hmm.
And you, instead of collecting, you start divesting.
Exactly.
And you start sorting and getting rid of things. And I know, like, there's Swedish death cleaning, and that's yeah, that same idea. And that it, for some people who follow this subculture in India, it goes even farther than that. And they divest themselves of everything. And they give their children whatever inheritance there might be. And then they go, and for the rest of whatever life they have, they live an aesthetic life. Or not an aesthetic life, an aesthetic life.
And COVID did that to a lot of us, kind of forced the issue without our making any decision. So, like, I am in that age range that you're speaking of. And I view things very differently at this point.
Yeah.
Than I did before COVID started. And I have spent 2 years, for the most part, in my house, and nobody was coming in and going out. Everything was Zoom, or it wasn't Zoom, or on the front porch.
Mm-hmm.
And that just changes. It's kind of like undoing your way of life. So I will be interested to see how this feels when I read top to bottom.
Mm-hmm.
But my habit has always been to read the end first and then read whatever you're reading. So,
uh-huh.
So this was just sort of natural. But I think that for lots of us, certainly not for all of us, but for lots of us, I think COVID kind of pushed the buttons for my age group, 80s and up, kind of pushed the thinking and the sensibility of it. Kind of gave, even for American people who are possession conscious, it pushed us quicker into that than we might have naturally found it, if we would have naturally found it. I find it much easier to be quietly doing something here in my yard or in my house and feeling the company of God. It just kind of is a natural fit because there's no other voices, mm-hmm. and except worry and concern and getting tied up in knots or leaning against a comfortable shoulder and saying, okay, some guidance, please.
Right. Let's move on to saying 39. I'll read this one. Yeshua said, "The Pharisees and the scribes have received the keys of knowledge and hidden them. They did not go within, and those who wanted to go there were prevented by them. As for you, be as alert as the serpent and as simple as the dove." Well, let's let that sink in for a moment of silence. What do you make of saying 39?
A lot of truisms. Mm-hmm. Those with the knowledge and the power tend to hide the access to it one way or another, whether it's government or church.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So since most of us don't have that kind of power, it behooves us to be as alert as the serpent, but as simple as a dove.
It's interesting to me because I hadn't heard it in other places translated quite like this, alert as the serpent and simple as the dove. And it makes me think that it's not, the serpent isn't attacking. The serpent is someone who is so completely aware and alert, they're noticing everything. But the simplicity of the dove is that they don't take action against others.
True.
So they're noticing everything, but they themselves have an unimpeachable record of what they've actually done.
Yeah, they don't too often tend to bully people out of, you know, where there's a feed on the ground or something. Mm-hmm. They share more and they seem to comfort more. I have mourning doves in the yard a lot. I also have a visiting hawk. And one of the things, and I have fed birds for the most part on and off forever. So there's often stuff on the ground. It's And when the hawk comes and takes one, which happens, you know, not often, but often enough that you observe it, I have noticed that the other doves, when they come back out, when things relax and simmer down, there's always one, so it must have been one of a pair, that mm-hmm. always stays close by where the hawk had made his kill. And just, it's almost like a mourning process. And then the others come around and they group around the one. And it's almost like an avian wake. And I've noticed, and it goes on for a couple of days sometimes. So there are sensibilities among these creatures that we live with, and a serpent. Everything that happens in the ground or in the air around a serpent is felt through every cell of the skin. It's not like it's just the head that works. It's the whole entire skin. And so a serpent always knows what's in front of or behind or above or under, wherever it is.
That's fascinating. I had no idea. And it makes it such a more vibrant metaphor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for a serpent. In fact, when you think about it that way, and my knowledge isn't scientific, it's just what you see and hear or observe, and I observe as few serpents as possible. But when you think about a serpent and how their skin is their sensibility, and so they seem to have some ability to know the presence of other things around them, all around them, in their own tiny little environment. They're all knowing in that sense of sensibility. And the devil in our stories comes to us as a serpent. I wonder if there's a connection and how that evolved in storytelling. People who were more familiar with serpents and in the desert coming up with these kind of stories, if that sort of sensibility might have entered into an all-knowing earth creature trying to devolve and undo an all-knowing heavenly creature.
Mm-hmm. And that's
sort of me today, this moment. That's not anything I've ever thought of.
Well, and that sense that we have an adversary, and you don't have to put a pitchfork in his hand and a forked tongue in his head. But there is a force in the universe that would like to undo us for reasons of its own. And it is as all-knowing as it can be. It is totally unrelenting. And it does nothing but lie. Everything is a lie. And you don't have to anthropomorphize it. You can. The Christian church has, and that's fine. But there is definitely a force that is antagonistic to humanity that also is very convincing to humanity.
Yes.
And has been very convincing since the dawn of time. And it is there's no doubt in my mind that in whatever contest it thinks it's in with God, God will win. And that that is just a matter of time. But in the meantime, we are stuck in the hell in between. And so thinking about it, as you had pointed out, to be as aware, as alert as the adversary.
Yeah.
To know and see that much, but to still have the mindset
of a dove.
Of God.
Yeah.
That's what I'm thinking of now. And there's a poem. It's Wendell Berry, maybe? The Mad Farmer Liberation Manifesto?
Mm.
I don't think I have it here. I might have it here. So go on and say what you were going to say, see if I can find
it. I was just thinking, serpenty, when you look at the ancient religions, how many of them had serpents in some form of picturing, like the Scandinavians have the serpent that surrounded the world. The Romans or the Greeks had the Medusa head of serpents.
Mm-hmm.
So serpents have always apparently been some aspect of religious iconography of in some degree.
And not all bad. Not all bad. So I found the poem. It is by Wendell Berry. It is Manifesto, the Mad Farmer Liberation Front. It's not a terribly long poem. I'll read it. Love the quick profit, the annual raise. Vacation with pay. Want more of everything ready-made. Be afraid to know your neighbor and to die. And you will have a window in your head. Not even your future will be a mystery anymore. Your mind will be punched in a card and shut away in a little drawer. When they want you to buy something, they will call you. When they want you to die for profit, they will let you know. So friends, every day, do something that won't compute. Love the Lord. Love the world. Work for nothing. Take all that you have and be poor. Love someone who does not deserve it. Denounce the government and embrace the flag. Hope to live in that free republic for which it stands. Give all your approval to all you cannot understand. Praise ignorance for what man has not encountered, he has not destroyed. Ask the questions that have no answers. Invest in the millennium. Plant sequoias. Say that your main crop is the forest that you did not plant, that you will not live to harvest. Say that the leaves are harvested when they have rotted into the mold. Call that profit. Prophesy such returns. Put your faith in the 2 inches of hummus that will build under the trees every 1,000 years. Listen to carrion. Put your ear close and hear the faint chattering of the songs that are to come. Expect the end of the world. Laugh. Laughter is immeasurable. Be joyful, though you have considered all the facts. So long as women do not go cheap for power, please women more than men. Ask yourself, will this disturb the sleep of a woman near to giving birth? Go with your love to the fields. Lie easy in the shade. Rest your head in her lap. Swear allegiance to what is highest in your thoughts. As soon as the generals and politicos can predict the motions of your mind, lose it. Leave it as a sign to mark the false trail, the way you didn't go. be like the fox who makes more trails than necessary, some in the wrong direction. Practice resurrection.
I like that.
Me too. One of the lines that has always stuck with me is, where is it? Now I'm missing it. It sticks with me, but not when I've just finished reading it.
So what was the title of that again?
That is entitled Manifesto, : The Mad Farmer Liberation Front.
Very timely.
Be joyful though you have considered all the facts.
Yeah.
That's the part that sticks with me.
Yep. And that's a trick. That's sort of like the poem in our book, Undoing Everything. Because if you consider all the facts, joy is not part of that.
And yet, when you, I don't know, it's not quite an innocence when, I don't know, it's the, there's something that leaves a bad taste in my mouth when I come up against not innocence, but naivete.
Yeah.
And it could be that I'm splitting hairs on that one.
And are you doing that United Way 21-day racial equity pledge thing that Mike Elkin put out?
No, but I'm considering looking into it.
I've been doing it. For me, it requires a deep dive, as Mike and I talked about it one day after church. I told him how long it takes me to go through each day that they give you. Challenges on it. But I have found it enlightening. I found it for me personally extremely useful, because naivety is apparently where I have spent most of my life. And I'm just constantly kind of, you know, hit on the side of my head, my gosh, I never would have thought of that, or, oh, really? And so if you're trying to take a very white Christian woman and stick her in the middle of a very black, shades of dark catastrophe and try to be helpful in any way, I keep thinking the only way I can be helpful is to figure out how to write a check and send it, because that won't be misinterpreted, but then maybe it will be misinterpreted. And there's so many ways of looking at every single thing. And it's not my, you know, I didn't grow up sensing racism. I had a black roommate in college, was horribly embarrassed when I brought her home and took her to our church and everybody moved to other pews. And that was in the early 60s. And I had spent time at her house in Queens, and nobody acted any different to me than anybody else. I didn't feel strange or weird or self-conscious at all because of any interactions. She came here and it was just a nightmare. It was one embarrassment after another. My family was wonderful, but and so were some of their friends, but there were other friends that it took a long time for them to come back into my mother and father's kind of scope of friends. Yeah, it was just, so I know that the problem is there. I never felt that I was part of that problem. I felt like I was on an understanding lane and I should be able to be helpful and I should be able to think my way out of a paper bag, but it doesn't seem to be. So each of the readings and things, it's just very helpful to me to realize how ignorant and naive I have been.
Well, and I don't want you to get too hard on yourself, because it's no matter where we start from, what we are honor bound to do is the best we can today. Without looking at the future and saying, but tomorrow I might be able to do so much better. And without looking at yesterday and saying, wow, well, I really messed up yesterday.
Yeah. Have to unfail the failings.
Yeah.
And unravel the expectations.
Yes. And that's part of my problem, is that when you tackle a problem, you go for the goal. Mm-hmm. And what you have to realize, in fact, I realized after reading one of the things, I got thinking about how each of us are like pieces in a giant jigsaw puzzle. And we are a piece. And when you have a giant jigsaw puzzle, it always fascinates me at how you pick up that piece and you have no idea where it's supposed to go. And the colors don't give you much of a hint, because the colors are not exactly the way you would have painted that picture. So when you find the place for it, it just is, holy cow, I never would have thought it goes there. I would have thought it went over there. And so that's how we are in this kind of racial thing, I think, is we're like individual puzzle pieces. We have to find our place, and we can't expect that we are the whole picture. We are this one tiny little spot, and that's a good thing to be, is one tiny little spot. It doesn't matter that you're not the whole solution to the problem.
Right. And I think part of the goal of all of this work is that if every single one of us becomes part of the solution rather than part of the problem.
Yes.
Then the problem gets smaller and smaller.
Yeah, just like the puzzle.
We're just like a puzzle. And we don't, one person, you know, we can look up to seminal leaders and think, wow, but look at them. They did so much work. And all the people who worked on that campaign or that project or that movement, they did so much work. And what am I doing? Like, I'm just whatever.
Exactly.
But the thing is, some people are called to do that. God bless them. That is God's will for them. That is their karma. That is the cross they have to bear. Pick your cultural reference. That's their thing. For the rest of us, I think the goal is to get out of the way. Get out of the way of progress. Support progress. Support new understandings and new ideas, and like the snake, shed our old skin and don't mourn it.
Right.
And be kind to yourself.
Right. And that is not to say that we cannot try to atone if we realize I've done something egregious.
Yes. In fact, one of the readings a couple nights ago that I did was to that effect, how to apologize. And to make it an acceptable sort of an apology, and not to expect it to make a huge difference on the other side.
That right.
Okay. I mean, the grievances are legitimate and huge.
Yeah.
And a simple apology from a singular person isn't going to make a huge difference. But it was just very, I have found the readings to be good and fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole project, I think, is sound. I'm just not sure how to make it go from my chair to some useful something. Right.
Well, I think I'm probably going to look into it, and I might do it, but not during the summer. Because there's too much time where I'm vacationing and doing other things, and there isn't enough time for me to focus on it.
Yeah.
And it deserves the focus.
Yes. Yeah, it does. If you sign up for the pledge, have you looked at it at all?
Nope.
Okay, if you go on to that thing for the pledge, and what Mike didn't know, and I'll be anxious to find out how this does work. What he didn't know, and I don't know how he came across this, because it's sponsored by the United Way of Western New York. Mm-hmm. And it's open for anybody. Mm-hmm. So you push the little pledge thing, mm-hmm. and pledge that you'll do 21 days of focusing on equity. Mm-hmm. And then from that point on, part of that is you give them your email address. So every morning, early, you get the next day's challenge. Mm-hmm. And it starts out with a paragraph just explaining the title of that day's challenge. Mm-hmm. But then it has three individual challenges for you to follow through on. Mm-hmm. And usually or frequently, it'll be one or two readings, articles, mm-hmm. from journal, you know, research pieces or something. Mm-hmm. Very informative. None of it was shocking to me, but it's informative from a white person's perspective to read so much from a colored person's perspective. Mm-hmm. I have found it very enlightening. And then there's one or two YouTube things depending, mm-hmm. on the day.
Right.
And each day has a totally different subject heading, mm-hmm. and of a problem aspect. Mm-hmm. And so it's very well done, very well organized, very well researched. You know, their pieces must have taken a lot of work for whoever originally did it, mm-hmm. just to get the permissions to put it out like this, because there's... it's professional writings, and it's, some of them are professional YouTube things.
Right. And well, I'm really looking forward to looking into it and possibly recommending it to, you know, the liaisons from my parish, but then the rest of my parish as well.
Well, Mike offered it to that Susan.
I can't remember her name. Yeah, her.
But anyhow, he emailed her after our last Zoom thing and said, you might want to take a look at this. And she said, well, yes, maybe later. And so, you know, who knows? I think now, do you have a liaison thing that's actually in progress?
Not at this point, no.
Pardon me?
Not at this point, no.
Oh, okay. Because we don't either.
No, and honestly, where we are in the parish is summer is a difficult time to plan things.
Yes.
And there are already priority things that have to happen. And so realistically, nothing on that line is going to happen in the parish until at least September. That's my guess.
And that sounded like that was pretty much the way, I mean, summer is summer and
right.
There isn't much you can accomplish. But what Mike had said early on when he started sharing this was he doesn't know how long the links will be live links.
Okay.
He's hoping that it'll be something that we can go back to for quite a period of time.
Mm-hmm.
But when something comes up in our processes, can remember, oh, there was an article on that. Let me share that. And we can go back to it. Mm-hmm. But he doesn't honestly know if that's feasible.
Right. No, that's a good point. So we'll do what we can.
Yeah. And if you have an opportunity to do it, my feeling is it's very worthwhile. I have gotten so much good out of it. And these are not topics that I haven't bought books on and been reading and keeping notes on for quite a few years. Mm-hmm. So it's not like it's a totally new subject or anything, but I've gotten so much insight from the pieces that they've chosen that I haven't been a major funder of United Way ever. I have kind of picked and chosen my own choices, but it makes me feel like if I have the opportunity and in the future, I should rethink that.
Right.
Because they have obviously hired somebody very gifted to put this together, or they have purchased somebody else's good product.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for the recommendation. I really appreciate it. And I honestly am much more likely to engage in it now. So thank you.
So maybe I should go into marketing. In another lifetime.
In another life. Well, we are a little bit over. So why don't we end it here? I will see you in... Next week.
And then that.
And then 2 weeks off.
Okay.
Yep.
Well, thank you.
As we go on vacation.
Nice sharing with you, Michael.
Well, thank you, Sue. Nice to talk to you.
All right. I'll see you next week.
Bye now.
Bye-bye.